Tomorrow marks the 50th anniversary of the launch of Apollo 11, which brought human beings to the surface of the moon for the first time. Even in today's world of technology, that event was one of the most remarkable accomplishments ever. Charles Fishman writes about the effort and the lasting impact of the moon landing in his new book, One Giant Leap, The Impossible Mission That Flew Us to the Moon. Charles Fishman, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, one of the things that you point out in this book is the scale of this effort of Apollo. Had there ever been anything like it in U.S. history to spend this much money and attention on this one thing, getting a human to land on the moon?
The scale is really unprecedented. 410,000 people worked on Apollo. For every hour that the Apollo astronauts were flying to the moon and walking around and then flying home, for every hour, 1 million hours of work done on Earth. That level of intensity was completely unprecedented.
Very expensive, too, and paid for by the taxpayers.
Well, I don't think it was very expensive. To me, that's one of the myths of Apollo that's worth unpacking. Apollo cost $19.4 billion. There were 2 years of the Vietnam War, each of which cost more than the entire space mission. Apollo lasted from 61 to 72, let's call it $20 billion. From 1961 to 1972, Americans spent $40 billion buying cigarettes.
Right, but that doesn't mean that it was easy for President Kennedy in the beginning to get the money from Congress to pay for what was needed for this.
No. In fact, right at the beginning, there was overwhelming support because Congress was as tired as President Kennedy was of being second to the Russians.
To the Russians.
Right. The Russians did everything first in space for 5 years, and Congress sort of viewed that as losing. Being second was losing. But what's interesting is that Americans were no more patient in the 1960s than we are today. By 1963, by 1964, Congress was like, this is costing a lot of money. When's it going to happen already? At the time he was assassinated, Kennedy was very worried about how to sustain the funding for at that point, what was going to be 4 or 5 more years.
Let's talk about how difficult it was to get a man on the moon. First of all, you know, these days we're all so used to using computers that we can put in our pockets that can do all kinds of things. Back in those days, there weren't computers. These were the first computers, really.
Here's the amazing thing. Any one of us who has an iPhone has more computing power not than flew to the moon. Your iPhone has more processing power than all the computers available to NASA at that time. When Kennedy said, let's go to the moon, it was simply impossible. The tools to do it did not exist. In 8 years, NASA and the 400,000 people working for NASA literally invented the rocket, the spaceship that could land on the moon, the spacesuits, all of that had to be invented from scratch. 10,000 problems had to be solved, and they solved all 10,000.
How connected is our digital world today to the technology that was created in the 1960s for NASA?
You know, I think this is the most important, most overlooked part of Apollo. It unleashed the digital age, and it gets absolutely no credit for that. That little computer that flew the spaceships to the moon and back was an absolute marvel. A small computer in the 1960s was the size of 3 or 4 refrigerators lined up. Mm-hmm. And MIT created a computer that was more powerful than the 4 refrigerators and faster, and that was run by the people who were using it, which was completely unheard of. And that computer was the first computer to use integrated circuits. It was the first computer to use computer chips. And so we start the 60s with no sense of the value of computers and a sense that, if anything, computers were unreliable. Mm-hmm. And we end the 60s with an all-new sense of both the importance of computers and their trustworthiness. We spent a decade watching people at consoles fly to the moon. And also a computer chip industry that understood that in order for computers to be valuable, the chips had to be fast, cheap, and perfect.
And you use the word unreliable. They had to, as you write, build reliability into the computers because you had to know that, there would be no way when you were on a mission to the moon for you to, you know, check to make sure that it was right. It had to be right.
The computers had to work perfectly. There's this sort of moment lost to history. John Glenn's flight in February 1962 was the first orbital flight of a spaceship for the United States. It lasted three orbits, 5 hours. And there was a big IBM computer in mission control in charge of that flight. And the IBM computer failed for 3 minutes. Okay, 3 minutes out of 300, no big deal. That was the most important computer in the world during that 5 hours. Mm-hmm. NASA needed Apollo flight computers. If the computer stopped working for 3 minutes, everybody died. So NASA needed computers absolutely bulletproof without any possibility of failure.
One of the things that you talk about in this book that I had not given much thought to is the flag that they planted on the moon. And I didn't even think about this, but a flag, of course, wouldn't wave and fly on the moon like it does on land in a windstorm. So how did they make it look so perfect for TV?
The story of the flag is kind of a little bit of a silly side story, but a reminder how hard even simple things were. First of all, NASA hadn't even planned to take a flag. And in April, 12 weeks before we went to the moon, somebody said, how are we going to celebrate this moment? And a technical engineer in Houston, a guy named Jack Kinzler, proposed the plaque, which rode on the lunar module attached to the leg. We came in peace for all mankind. And he came to NASA officials with this very ingenious flag design. And his idea was that there were actually going to be two aluminum poles. There was the one, the vertical one, and it was hinged at the top to a pole that was horizontal. And if you look at the pictures, it's very clear that the flag is, quote unquote, flying because it's hanging from a horizontal pole as well.
And this matters because there had to be a flag. There was even a question you write about whether they wanted to put a UN flag on the moon, but and members of Congress said absolutely not. It's got to be an American flag.
This was a, you know, Americans spent the money, we will hoist an American flag. For that first moon landing, the raising of the flag and Armstrong and Aldrin alongside it was the front page photo in half the papers of the world, which is kind of amazing given that they almost didn't do it.
Why do you think that putting a man on the moon was so important then? And these days, it seems that NASA is much happier to send a robot. I mean, of course, we do send people into space, but we haven't sent a person to Mars yet, for example. You know, it's difficult, no question. But is it more difficult than it was in 1969 to send a man to the moon?
Not only we haven't sent anybody back to the moon, no one's gone back to the moon since 1972. And once we had done it, there were no economic imperatives to keep going. I think what's really exciting in the world of space today, in fact, is what's going on in near-Earth orbit, what Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and a guy named Robert Bigelow are doing. They're trying to make space flight inexpensive, routine, and unthinkingly safe, the way air travel is. What will be really interesting is if you can lower the price of going to space from $100 million a flight to $1 million a flight, you'll unleash the kind of innovation that happened when we went from, you know, modems to high-speed internet.
But don't you think that there was a difference in terms of the inspirational quality in having a person go instead of a robot? And then does that same thing exist today or not any longer? Or is it, wow anybody to send a person up there anymore?
There's no question that robots do wonderful science, but human contribution is invaluable and also can't be predicted. There's this wonderful moment when Armstrong and Aldrin on Apollo 11 get back in the lunar module. They unsnap their helmets, and the entire cabin of the lunar module is filled with this smell, the smell of lunar dirt, sort of like burned charcoal, or Aldrin said, the smell of the air after a fireworks show. No robot could tell you that the moon had a smell. We haven't gone back because there hasn't been either an economic or political imperative, and it is really hard. If it were easy, we would have gone back. Mars is 100 times harder than the moon. It's the difference between traveling for 3 days and traveling for 3 years.
Right, but our computers are much better than they were back then. Could probably handle it. Charles Fishman, you have written about water. You have written about Walmart. Now this story of the first moon landing. How do you get so excited about these different topics?
What I love is to try and understand how people get their work done. And, you know, in 8 years, we invented spaceflight. We invented all the tools we needed, from miniaturized computers to space food. I wanted to understand what it was about the spirit at that moment and the commitment to sort of try and appreciate what we can bring forward from that. Every single day of the 4 years I spent working on this, I discovered some little surprise. There were only three people authorized to fold the parachutes for Apollo space capsules. And they were so important to NASA that NASA forbid them to ever ride in the same car together so that they
just
couldn't
in case
be,
they got in a crash.
So they couldn't all be injured at the same time. When you find a story like that every day, you sort of think, this is going to be something people love to learn about.
That's Charles Fishman, whose new book is called One Giant Leap, The Impossible Mission That Flew Us to the Moon, which, by the way, was 50 years ago. Charles, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.